This is Mindframe, a podcast of mind-bending science fiction. I'm Dave Moten, the author of Mindframe, and as always, the narrator. And with me is Brent Van Tassel, my producer and partner in all things Mindframe. And we bring you once again a Christmas special. And we did it a year ago, the premise being I'm a longtime fan of Doctor Who, and I've always loved the fact that they always make a special Christmas episode of the show, and it's often one of the best episodes of the year. And I've always been a fan of that and the idea of that. So we strive to have a Christmas episode as part of Mindframe. So if you're listening to this as it drops, then Merry Christmas, and it is a Christmas episode. And if you're listening to it sometime later, you're going to see pretty quickly that the whole thing is a Christmas episode anyway. So Merry Christmas coming soon or a while ago, depending on when you listen to it. So as always, a couple of orders of business up front. First off, we just want to thank Podbelly. We are a Podbelly original, and we are a proud member of the Podbelly Podcast Network. If you like podcasting, go check out what they have. There's a lot of great shows on there. If you just go to podbelly.com, you'll find us there, and you'll find some other shows that you can listen to. And also, we always want to thank our patrons. Our loyal patrons keep it going. A lot of times when I'm behind on deadlines or I'm just not feeling it and I don't want to write, if I see the patrons leave a comment, or even just fans who aren't patrons, it really inspires me and does make me want to write. So I really appreciate you. If you want to become a patron, you can go to patreon.com/mindframepodcast. And for just a dollar, you get our sit-down episodes, which we record, and they are always the behind the scenes of our chapters and talking about writing process and all kinds of science fiction. So check that out if it's something that you're interested in. So for this very special Christmas episode of Mindframe, we go back to Captain Claire Campana. And by way of reminder, where we last left Claire, she had just accepted the Alpha and his retinue to board the Eleanor Gray, and they were going to go on the mission to find the Deviant Alpha. And shortly after he boarded, he ended up presenting her with a video of her father engaged in a black op mission that apparently killed a bunch of deviants, and then he turned and killed his own men and walked out of the station. And she was quite shocked to discover new things about her father. So we leave off just a couple of short hours after that, as she begins to investigate exactly what's happening with her father, and of course continues trying to figure out what is up with the notions of a Deviant Alpha. So I hope you enjoy this special Christmas episode, and we'll see you on the other side. Chapter 32, Claire Campana, 2142. The surface of Jupiter bellowed below Claire. Her view from the shuttle was astounding. People spoke of the Great Red Spot as the draw of Jupiter, but it wasn't. It was all of the place. The eternal, unfathomable storms that merged one from each and swirled below her. It was a tapestry of muted blues and pale whites and unlikely oranges. Her human mind tried to impose order on the chaos, tried to pretend this storm system looked like eyes and an elongated mouth, or that one looked like a cream poured into a dark tea, but it was nothing like that. It was storms of poison, roiling the size of the planet Earth. She could only use the word awe to describe her reaction. The magnitude of the beauty and the noxiousness of the pressures and chemical composition all made this thing truly akin to its namesake, an ancient god of unsounded power. Jupiter, Jove, the Roman version of Zeus. She had to wonder about the ancient gods. Was it true that the Roman and Greek gods were the same beings but with different names? What if they were entirely different sorts of entity? To the naked eye for a human standing in the hills of Mexico, Mars in the night sky would appear no more extraordinary than 1,000 other stars. They were the same thing, a glowing stellar body. But the terrestrial Mars couldn't compare to the grandiosity of a star, not even to a gas giant like Jupiter. Years ago, she was stationed on dockyards over Mars, and was never this astounded at its scope and beauty. It didn't compare to Jupiter. "Captain," Begay asked, cutting into Campana's train of thought. He sounded like this wasn't the first time he had said it. She had lost herself in the scope of ceaseless storms. Its magnificence cut through the horrible video of her father murdering children, distracted her somehow even of that. But now, she was back in the shuttle fully, her consciousness merged with her body. "I'm sorry," she said, "I was lost in everything. I was just asking if you ever thought it would be this beautiful. My grandfather told stories of his time serving on the Old Dame. He said the first human trip to Jupiter was the thing that would never leave his eyes when he closed them at night." Begay was being his normal chatty self, but Kampana could tell he was talking to cover up his nerves. He had no idea what he was doing here. It was unheard of for the captain and the first officer to both leave the ship at the same time, much less on a shuttle during the night watch, without leaving a record in the ship's log. They placed Commander Wen in charge of the ship, though he still seemed not quite right after whatever the Alpha had said to him when their contingent boarded from the Tehachapi. Plus which, the Alpha was on board. Kampana had showed up at Begay's door at 1 a.m. and asked him for a personal favor as a friend. She asked him to accompany her down to Ganymede, no questions asked, and to cover their tracks so the World Navy wouldn't know the mission had occurred. At first she could see the doubts in Begay's eyes, but they turned to concern, and finally an understanding. It had something to do with the Alpha. Yes and no. But now was the time to debrief him. Kampana used his first name, and was intentionally casual, as she said, "Harmon, thank you for trusting me and coming with me on this. I want you to watch something." "No, that's not true. I need you to watch something. Want has nothing to do with what this is," she said, hitting play, without waiting for him to agree to it. It was the video of her father, and the killing. She opted to watch the churn of Jupiter instead of the monitor, but she heard the film play. And then she heard it play a second time. Begay started to speak and then stopped, with his mouth open, as he tried to process what was happening. The comm system chirped. It announced a line request from Alpha Actual on board the Eleanor Gray. "Open the channel," the captain said. Begay did so. The Alpha came on, saying, "Claire, I couldn't help but feel like you just shared some of your recent discovery with the commander." "I did," Kampana said. "And how did that make you feel, Harmon?" "Confused, sir. Is it a fake? Deviant propaganda?" "I assure you, no," the Alpha said. Begay replied, "Well, no naval officer would do such a thing, especially not Captain Kampana." The Alpha laughed a single long ha, followed by shorter ha's. Claire had never heard a laugh that was actually a ha, ha, ha. The old man was laughing at the naivete, she thought, that she and Begay were just now shedding. "The World Navy will do whatever it needs to do in order to advance humanity and complete the Lariat. Its officers will do the same, young man. Did she tell you about the Deviant Alpha?"
"No, sir, she did not."
"You did not," Begay said, shifting his conversation over to Kampana. "I'll leave you two to catch up," the Alpha said. "Or debrief, I suppose you'll call it. I've sent you the access code to the Nile habitat, Claire. Put them on tight beam and she'll let you in on all her dirty little secrets. I've got your Commander Wen talking to some settlements on Ganymede and doing random scans from the captain's chair. They are all utterly confused and busy up here. I might even sing them a song, so do your thing." Claire didn't know that she wanted the Alpha's help with the Eleanor Gray's crew, but he was the only way they could truly cover up this clandestine landing party. Nobody would ask questions of the Alpha's odd requests, and he had the authority to erase Navy protocol and shut down entire sensor suites and lock down entire decks. The shuttle reoriented itself. Jupiter rotated out of view as they entered the thin atmosphere of Ganymede, with the ship aimed downward to land. Begay said, "A Deviant Alpha." "That's the theory. Commodore Nechayev? He told me about it when he gave me the mission to rendezvous with the Tehachapi. He said only a handful of people even know about it, not even all of WorldGov Enclave. That's why the Alpha's here, and somehow, my father and his mission to kill these people are all intertwined."
"How so?" Begay asked.
"That's what we're about to find out," Kampana said, and the shuttle sounded that it was beginning its final approach on the scene of the murder, the Deviant Habitat, on Ganymede.
the shuttle landed outside of the habitat on Ganymede's soil. It was the fourth solar body Campana had ever rested on. Earth, obviously, with some time on Luna, a brief furlough on Mars, and now Ganymede. Thousands of people lived in this Jovian moon, but all in the lower elevations where gravity might help an atmosphere slowly pool as part of the terraforming efforts. Though the habitat was camouflaged from aerial surveillance, she still wondered how none of the moon's inhabitants had found this Nile in all these years. But then she thought about the mountains in Mexico. Cartels used to grow and manufacture drugs in those mountains while evading multiple governments. In spite of recent technology, a well-hidden base in a massive mountain range would simply never be found, especially if someone didn't even know to look for it. Campana had told Begay the little that she knew about the possibility of a deviant alpha as they waited. The shuttle had taken control over the Nile's systems, and it was powering up and restoring atmosphere. It would only take a few more minutes, and then they could land in its bay and investigate without pressure suits. "If they have a messenger, then they might have new technology that hasn't been beamed down to us," Begay said. "They do," Campana agreed. The ship and the weapons that killed the crew of the Grey were both of unknown make. Begay paused to take this in, finally saying, "Then they must have a different faction or government that's sending them the tech, a different agenda than the Lariat." The weight of a new alien faction settled in on Claire. The Deviants weren't just an organized group of terrorists and rebels. They were quite possibly the army and intelligence apparatus of an alien species or government. Someone other than the Kel Demokratia was involved in the affairs of Earthlings. She said, "Or the same agenda, to open the Lariat, but open it to them, not to us." "Not to the Kel," Begay said. "The Kel somehow don't feel much like us at the moment." "Fair enough," Claire said. The shuttle announced that the pressure and oxygen levels were normalized in the habitat. They docked, and the shipping doors slid shut behind them. The Nile-style habitat structure was very popular. They were simple cubes, four stories tall. They were engineered to be droppable from space. The heat shielding that was on the bottom of them would wick off the dangers of re-entry, and then when on free fall in the normal atmosphere, they would rotate to the top of the structure and deploy as a series of parachutes and wing slats, letting them land with some precision. They had no thruster and weren't meant to ever launch again. They were designed to be retrieved by heavy cargo haulers, but they seldom were. It was cheaper to leave them and build a new one than it was to send a mission to gather one back up. Plus, they were incredibly hardy, lasting for decades without much maintenance before needing a replacement. The Niles were about 80% identical. The main entry was a large docking/cargo bay. It could hold several shuttles or M34 short-fin all-purpose land rovers. The short fins actually locked into slots in the flooring, so they could be ready with the Nile's initial drop. On the other side of the docking bay sat the main hall of the Nile. The hall was three stories tall and wide open. This allowed for oversized machines, most often mining sifters, and cargo stacks. In this central area, there was often a main mess hall for the population or a medical bay, sectioned off with movable cubicle partitions. The four outer walls and the upper level were dedicated to specialized rooms. These were modular when any particular Nile was constructed. They could be labs and living quarters and latrines. They could be jail cells and armories and vaults and kitchens. There were lifts in the east and north corners and stairwells in the west and south of the cubicle structure. They could withstand high gravity, hard radiation, punishing weather, radical heat, and deadly cold. They had small but powerful energy vehicle reactors that could last 50 years, but in extreme conditions or for especially high demand work, a separate power plant could be launched with the Nile and connected on site. Inside the docking area of this Nile, Captain Campana and Commander Begay found three M34 short fin rovers. There was a large dark stain on the plating where the Deviants who once lived here were lanced down with beam weapons by Bill Campana's Dark Op Marine Force some years ago. All the bodies were gone, sucked out into the near vacuum of Ganymede. They were probably scattered about in front of the Nile, either grinning in states of mummified non-decay or burned to cinder and gone, depending on how Ganymede did its thing. Claire didn't know and hadn't thought about the corpses until just this moment. She'd have liked to lay the bodies to rest if they still existed. Claire exited the shuttle and walked immediately to the M34 that had filmed the murder with its dash cam. The bio tags on her naval blacks told the door she had access, and it unlocked. She took a small toolkit from her leg sleeve and made quick work of removing the camera and the hard drive of the rover. She placed all of it in her leg sleeve just as the docking bay itself had pressurized. She dropped down out of the tall cab of the M34 and saw Begay scanning the atmosphere on his sleeve's computer and HUD. He liked what he saw and had his helmet retract, giving Campana a thumbs up. She left her helmet on. Once they entered the main hatch into the structure itself and were out of the cargo bay, she finally let herself breathe the air here. Once her helmet retracted, she instantly heard music. It was low res and grainy and playing over the Nile's entire comm system. The song started with a heavy horn section, lots of French horns, and was joined by the gentle tinkle of a xylophone and some light guitar. It was serene. Begay looked as if the music piqued his interest and said, "No life signs, Captain. This must be automated, playing when the power was cut off." She nodded at him and the song continued. A male singer started. His voice was shining mercury, smooth and liquid. He was a crooner from the last century, she reasoned. He said, "Silent night, holy night, all is calm and all is bright. Round yon virgin mother and child, holy infant so tender and mild, sleep in heavenly peace." Then the singer repeated, "Sleep in heavenly peace." The lyrics and tone and message seemed painfully perfect for this tomb. Wishing the dead heavenly peace. She'd never heard the song before. Her arm buzzed information, and when she looked down, it was simply a recognition match. The computer said it was a song called Silent Night. Composers Gruber and Moore, 1818. Singer Michael Bublé, 2011. The album was simply called Christmas. In front of Campana and Begay sat several shipping containers, and beyond them a vast series of towering equipment connected to dishes and receivers scraping the fourth story of the Nile habitat. She decided to open the first container to see what they were storing. Her uniform unlocked the metal door with a beep, and she had to wrench at the metal handle pretty good to get it to open. It was full of the body parts of the murdered. The beam of her light fell on the severed head and shoulder of a child of maybe 11, and the leg of a muscular man laying in a random, unending bed. There was no sense of smell because everything in there was still frozen from the years that the Nile was powered down. Regardless, Claire started to retch and slid the container closed. The naval part of her brain that was trained to stay on task even in the face of horror started to put things together. First, someone retrieved them all from the surface of the moon, and it wasn't her father since he was last seen calling for his extraction. Second, the bodies were rotten and decayed, which meant someone had an internal atmosphere and temperature running inside of this Nile for long enough for them to rot. The assumption was that this place had been abandoned since the slaughter, but someone had lived here after. Based on her reaction, Begay was approaching rapidly to see what was inside, but she held out a hand to stop him. "It's a grave," she said, regaining her composure, just as the chorus of children started to sing the same Silent Night lyrics in a slow, haunting fashion. It was hard to make out their words over the intercom, plus which it was in English, not common. She had learned English as part of her language studies and knew Spanish from growing up, but she hadn't heard either in years. If she was translating properly, the lyrics to the song now said something about radiant beams emanating from a face and something about Jesus at his birth. So this was an old religious song. A church hymn, she guessed, as the man, Michael Bublé, came in with that amazing voice again, singing, "Jesus, Lord, at thy birth." "Captain, what is our objective here other than the Short Fin's hard drive?" "Answers? I don't know. What were they doing here? Who came back after the slaughter and sealed away the bodies? Who left this music playing and where is it coming from?" "Roger that," Begay said. "Should we split up and cover more ground?" Campana nodded. "That sounds reasonable. There's no risk of a deviant surviving zero atmo in here for all these years. But keep an open mind and an open eye, Harmon. Whatever we find up here is going to be... Claire didn't know what it was going to be. Awful, shocking, inexplicable. Begay spared her the adjective and said, "Aye, Captain. I'll go look at those dishes and receivers, see what they were monitoring." "Good, I'm going to head to 4. Usually executive offices and data collection are up there in most Nile configurations. If you go up, take the stairs. Don't trust the lifts to work. And Harmon, I'm Claire on this one, not your captain." Begay smiled and said, "I'd have hugged you just now, but we'd look ridiculous trying to do it through these suits." He winked, and she didn't remember if she knew he was a winker. Claire patted Begay on the shoulder and squeezed it. He reached up and pressed her hand against him with a bit of pressure. She smiled a surprisingly genuine smile and headed to the nearest staircase as the song rounded out in a smooth and diminishing finish. The song that followed it was the same singer, but a radically different cadence. She thought it sounded like music from the Gulf, New Orleans maybe. Long, languorous horns that sounded sexy somehow. The singer was wishing his audience a blue Christmas. So this one was religious as well. Christmas was one of the two big Christian holidays. Her best friend growing up back in Tijuana was Maria Valenzuela. The two of them spent most weekends staying at one or the other's house. Toward the end of every 13th month, her household would decorate. They'd string lights and puffy bits of thin metal they'd call tinsel. They'd put ornaments on a tree, eat a huge feast with lots of tamales, fill oversized knit socks with treats, and swap brightly colored gifts. She was invited to stay the night one time on the eve before Christmas, and the holiday joy and love she felt from the family was unique, especially considering the sparse nature of her own Navy brat family life. Claire crossed the open area of the Nile habitat and closed in on the stairs. On the song, the horns were swinging and the feel was one of a drunken dance hall, not the solemnity of the church. She was glad for it. The first song felt like it was about to summon all the ghosts that were drifting through this place, but this one felt like it was distracting the specters with a sprightly dance. She climbed to the 4th floor. Levels 1 through 3 were all open to the central courtyard, but the 4th was entirely closed off. The doors to 4 slid open, and she found a hallway that broke in a few directions. The song switched again as she walked through. Their style and content changed, but most dealt with Christmas. References to the warmth of a fire, a desire for inclement weather and snow, presents, and seemingly lovers and children were prominent. They tended to be slow and rely on bells jingling in the background. It was a strange genre of music, and the computer said it was all from the same album. The 4th floor was decorated with small pin lights and long cords. The effect was quite soothing, like looking at a flock of fireflies. There were wrapped presents here and there, typically in gold, green, and red paper. The walls were lined with the long strands of 3D-printed pine branches and wreaths of fake pine and pine cones. It was very much like Maria's house every month of democracy when her family would decorate. As Claire rounded the main hall, she heard the sound of the music coming from a source other than the central speakers. She headed to a room with an open door. Inside was a record player that looked a few hundred years old, but was obviously printed out of Ganymede soil, just like everything else here would have been. A cord plugged it to the comm unit, so the whole place could hear the music. A stack of vinyl records was next to the player on the table. Campana flipped her space gloves off and locked them to the sleeve. She then could use regular-sized fingers and flip through the records. They all had something to do with the Christian holiday. She left the record playing. This particular suite was some sort of communication hub. It was dimly lit, mostly to the glow of monitors. They all showed live feeds of the storms raging down on the surface of Jupiter. A partition broke the room in half, and she rounded the corner to see what was on the other side. There was a very strange device. It looked like a dentist table or an imaging device of some sort. An angled seat was meant to take her whole body and make it comfortably sit still while slightly upward. It had straps to hold the body down, but they looked like the person sitting had control of them, not like something from a prison. It was mostly made of gold metals, and there was a condensation mist forming over a gray metal tube that surrounded the headrest. Cables ran from this medical table through the floor and walls. A small, movable stainless steel table had two bottles of medicine on it. In a thick black pen and neat handwriting, a label on one bottle simply said before, and the label on the other bottle said after. The seat gave the ticking that metal did when it was rapidly cooling or heating, and there was a high-pitched hum coming from it and landing somewhere deep in Claire's teeth. On the other side of this large, strange seat was a single computer and monitor, and sitting in an office chair was a frozen, dead body. Claire was expecting to find signs of battle and corpses everywhere. The people in the video looked like they had been through a rough battle, but the place had been cleaned up, and this corpse was likely the janitor. She moved closer to find that it was a woman, and she had apparently died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. She wore a scientist jumpsuit, and her name tape said Noelle. A software window designed to call for an extraction team sat open on the computer monitor. On the wall behind the monitor, written in the same handwriting as the bottles, a countdown was listed. It said days alone, followed by hash mark clusters of five. She counted them up. 247. Then below that, it said days with Misty. Those came to 28. Campana found a lab coat on a hook and placed it over the woman's head and chest. She took another and covered up the blood, bone, and brain that were on the floor and part of the wall. It was thawing in the newly activated heat and was sure to start smelling soon. She heard Begay's footsteps coming closer, and she took the pistol from the woman's lap. She emptied it of ammunition and put it in one of her suit sleeves. "What is this place?" Begay asked, walking into the room. "I'm as baffled as you, Harmon." "And who was that woman? A lone survivor, I'd have to assume?" "Only thing that makes sense. No signs of other ships or vehicles after my father extracted. And this," she said, pointing to the hash marks on the wall. "She'd been here quite some time. It looked like she was about to call for a rescue but opted to kill herself."
"Curiouser and curiouser," Begay said.
"There's a mining settlement not far from here. Thousands of people live on Ganymede. She could have driven an M34 to a population center within a couple of days. Do you think she didn't go get help because she was a deviant?"
Campana said, "I think she didn't because she wanted to complete their mission."
"Which was?" Begay asked.
"That, my friend, is the question of the hour."
They sat and used a tablet to assemble a narrative of clues and information. It turned out this habitat was devoted to communication and apparently weather control. It would modify the clouds on Jupiter and then closely monitor them in various spectrums. When Claire and Harmon looked at the tech, it seemed that most of it was now automated, and it was controlled by the strange medical chair. Or no, not controlled by it, activated by it. Whoever sat in the chair didn't control anything, but they could tell the system to run their programs. The devices here would modify the storms, scan them, and then... what? Being in the chair was obviously crucial, and whatever was meant to happen in that chair was a big enough threat to WorldGov that Claire's father came here and slaughtered everyone. But why was it still here? Why didn't the World Navy scoop this habitat up? Were they waiting for deviants to come so they could track their movements? That seemed like a fair bet. All of this was discussed by Campana and Begay over some coffee they pressed out of the galley on floor 2. It was almost 3 in the morning, and they had had a long day dealing with speeches, the press, the Alpha, and the truth about Claire's father. Begay's suggestion was that they send a team down, study this more in depth, get their engineers to figure out the purpose of the chair. It obviously used some sort of back-engineered messenger technology. It could be used to do just about anything. Claire's decision went a different way. She sent Begay back to the galley to get more coffee. As soon as he left for the refill, she opened the bottle of pills that said before. It was filled with large white capsules, too big to comfortably swallow. She popped one in her mouth and drank from the straw in her suit. She sat in the chair and looked for controls. There were buttons that locked the legs and arms, and there was a big red button that said go written in it in the same black pen. She had to know what all this was.
what was good enough for her father to kill over. He had known what this place did when he killed children and his own Marines. The Alpha came here to investigate a Deviant Alpha. Was the Deviant Alpha this Noelle person, dead due to a self-inflicted gunshot wound? Was it someone else and they built this whole facility to do something to whoever sat in this chair? Claire strapped herself in and felt cold emanating from the hissing tube surrounding her head. She popped her neck, shook her head, and pressed go. Claire was curled up under a blanket with Maria. The small home was decorated just like she remembered it. The tree was glowing with twinkling LED bulbs, and music was playing from a small speaker in the corner. More Christmas music, this time in Spanish. It was Norteño music with a classic accordion and bass driving the song. The singer was male, less talented than that Bublé, and singing about God coming down to sit with families at Christmas, even if all they had was a scrap of bread to eat. It was definitely a pre-World Vote Christmas song. It may have been the old band Los Tigres del Norte, but it could have been one of a dozen others that her grandmother would listen to over and over. The house smelled of cinnamon and citrus from the punch the Valenzuelas would often keep burning on the stove during the 13th month and through the new year. Maria was checking her feeds or playing a game on her skinterface. She looked like she was 13 again. All Claire could think to say was, "What?" And Maria looked up at her. Maria's expression changed from a passive feed consumer to someone as shocked as she was. She looked around the room, stared at the speaker, and then finally made eye contact with Claire. "Hiya," she said in common. "We're in Mexico, but I'm assuming common is better for you than Spanish?" "Yes," Claire said, suddenly pulling her legs away from the warmth of Maria's lap where they had been resting. She slid out from under the blanket and stood. "Where's Dr. Noel?" Maria asked. "Dead," Claire replied. Oh, that's sad. She was very warm and inquisitive. I think the isolation was driving her mad, though. I'm assuming she decided not to get rescued? Or wait, are you her rescue party? Did it all go sideways?" Claire said, "No, she's been dead for some time. Who are you exactly?" "Ha, that's the question. Who am I?" That's never been answered to a human satisfaction. You try to be a bit coy and stretch things out with a hint here and a hint there until you feel the person can handle the raw fact of it all. The first one was the worst, took forever. Maybe let's start with your other questions and build up to that one. What a sad song, the poverty of humanity before the Kel rearranged you. Claire started a checklist of questions to ask and was also gathering information. She didn't know how she got to Tijuana, but she was here. She could see the street out the window, smell all the smells of the Zona Rosa that she didn't know were so prominent. The gravity was right, the atmospheric pressure. That chair, what did it do exactly? Ah, the chair puts you in communication with the artificial mind that the array in the Nile habitat builds in the clouds of Jupiter, Maria answered. Claire was certain she hadn't asked that question out loud. Maria said, "You didn't, Claire. Human minds are quite loud. I don't mean to hear your thoughts, but it's almost impossible not to." Claire asked, "An artificial mind in the clouds? That's what this place does? It creates an artificial mind?" Maria nodded her head and tucked the red and green plaid blanket under her knees, getting comfortable on the couch. "Yep, that's what it does." That wasn't what it was supposed to do, but Dr. Noel was literally a genius when it came to adapting technology nobody understood. She was a trained back engineer for WorldGov's messenger branch before she became a deviant. "Okay," Claire said, though it wasn't. "So this place builds an artificial mind." "Correct," said Maria, suddenly seeing a mug of warm fruit punch sitting on a coaster shaped like a reindeer. She picked it up and took a deep inhale and then a tentative drink. She pursed her lips and raised her eyebrows as if she was pleasantly surprised. She took another drink. Claire waited patiently. Maria continued, "The technology in your Nile is a tweak on the weather mod satellites you use around Earth. It sends signals that make the clouds move in certain ways. It is quite grotesque and invasive, and your people should follow the galactic ban on its use, but that's just my own bias speaking. that was meant to form certain types of storm fronts and clouds on the surface of Jupiter. Claire found a seat in the corner by the Christmas tree and sat there. It had a good view of the room's entrances and was near a window she could slip out of if she needed to. There were no visible weapons in the room, but a fireplace poker and an articulating lamp would do in a pinch. "Death by desk lamp," Maria laughed as the song faded to a new one. "Too much. This song is depressing too. I thought Christmas music was supposed to be uplifting." "What exactly is an artificial mind?" Claire asked. "Piff, piff, piff. That's the least important and least interesting part of what's going on right now, Claire. The artificial mind was a complete and utter failure at the deviants' attempts to create sentient cloud life in the storms of Jupiter. The conditions aren't right, so no self-sustaining life could ever be attained. The best they could do is get a blank mind to assemble with the proper gaseous infrastructure and electrical layers. It would only last for maybe an hour before dispersing. But in that hour, my people could detect it and talk to it. And Noel, the builder of that golden chair, could use said golden chair to talk to my people, which meant me. So your antennas built a neural cloud, and your Noel built a chair. The chair lets humans talk to the cloud, and the cloud lets the cloud talk to me. And just like that, you've created a link across the galaxy to an alien mind. Congratulations, Claire. You're the next best thing to a messenger. Only, apparently, a lot less crazy. Claire was astounded. This technology was letting her do what only the strongest and most awoke minds on Earth could do. It made someone like herself, with an average score in the aptitude tests, to be a 1 in a billion level mental power. "Don't get ahead of yourself, Claire. It only works with my race, not anyone in the Kel." Claire asked, "So there really was a deviant alpha messenger? It was Dr. Noel?" "Well, I can't unpack all of that with a yes or a no. There was really a person that WorldGov would label a deviant. That person could really talk to an alien mind that is part of an interstellar organization. That person was Dr. Noel. She is dead. By suicide, I see, and you found her body. She never did call for help. Her conundrum was that a call for help would possibly alert WorldGov and they would get this technology, which they now did because you're captain of the Eleanor Gray and your alpha messenger is in orbit around this moon, so her death was in vain." Claire shook off how much this person seemingly knew about her and her mission and continued on, asking, "So you're a living alien being, and I'm talking to you live time from across the galaxy. From the far side of Sagittarius A black hole, all the way to you in the scutum crux arm of the Orion Spur. I still enjoy saying that." Claire held her hand out and shook her head to tell Maria to be quiet. "Okay, stop. Please stop. I need to think." Maria laughed a laugh that wasn't Maria's laugh, and she said, "Yes, you do. In fact, of all the times you've ever really needed to think in your life, this is totally in the top 10. Top 5, maybe. I'll be quiet. This needs a warm-up," Maria said, and headed into the kitchen with her mug of punch. Claire stared at the lights blinking around the unlit fireplace. She needed to think, but was incapable of thought. She just stared at the lights, feeling a deeper and deeper sense of nothingness in her mind. It was the exact thing she feared would happen if she became a captain. When everything mattered the most, she wouldn't be able to process the facts and make a decision, form a question, devise a tactic. The warmth of cinnamon, cloves, lemon, and apple woke her sinuses up. She was sipping on a fresh mug of the hot punch, and her childhood flooded her brain. She might as well have been 13 again, sitting in Maria's living room. Her parents would have been in the kitchen cooking tamales and would have shooed the girls out because they'd have grown bored by now and would just be making dirty shapes with the masa and giggling. The house would be heavy with steam from the boiling pots. Maria's cute cousins would be over soon, and then Claire's own mother would come for the dinner. Her father was, of course, in space. In fact, when she was 13, he very well may have been flying to Ganymede to murder children younger than she was in this echo of Christmas that existed out of space and time. She finally asked, "Where and when am I? Is this a mind frame?" "Great start," Maria beamed, tapping her finger to the side of her nose and winking. "We are in your now, just a few minutes after you sat down in the golden chair. You are in the chair, and I am at home. Mind frame? No. Different. A mind frame is the protective artifact of a framing chamber. The human mind can't deal with this ethereal mental space without a framework to anchor to. It goes mad. So I've learned to help humans construct a mind space out of their own memories and preferences, or, to be honest, places they don't like. Just to fuck with them, or teach them something, or both. Often both, but this was your mind's first go-to for some reason, so I went with it. It's festive. Claire took this in and allowed herself another sip. Maybe the punch was what was snapping her out of her fugue. And who are you? Maria put her hand on her chest and made a face as if she were about to cry. Well, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to care. The first human I talked to named me Misty, which is who I am, I suppose. You picked the Maria frame to talk to. I have no control about that. That was interesting and confusing to Claire, but not mission critical. She moved past it, asking, and what do you do, Misty? A lot of things, I suppose. But do you mean what is my function within my society, what you would call a job? Claire said, yes, that's exactly what I mean. That is a great question, too. See, look at you, get in your groove. I'm the ambassador between a group known as the Cincture and all sentient species of the planet Earth and said planet's solar system. The Cincture. This is one of the groups opposed to the Kel Demokratia? No, Misty, as Maria said. We are not opposed. We aren't at war. One of us isn't evil and one good. We're different groups of space aliens, separated by unimaginable distances, but joined together by unimaginable technologies. And when your domestic portal opens, what you call the Lariat, we'll all be joined with you as part of the galactic whole, Misty said, sitting back down on the couch and snuggling under the blanket. So you're not enemies with the Kel, like the Deviants are to WorldGov? Again, Claire, the question is not simple to unpack. No, the Cincture and the Kel are not enemies. But I would argue that the Deviants and WorldGov are not enemies. Both sides want what is best for the Earth. In a galactic sense, true enemies are not both fighting for the best end result of both parties. They tend to be fighting to wipe one another out of existence or to fully enslave or displace each other. None of the four groups you've put on the table really want to see such extreme conclusions. Claire asked, so what does the Cincture want? Well, let's rewind. I'm going to ask you a question. What does WorldGov want? Claire wondered if this being actually knew what WorldGov wanted and went from suspicious to patriotic, thinking she might school Misty on the facts of WorldGov. She said, WorldGov, and by extension the vast majority of human and dolphin on and around planet Earth, have dedicated themselves to true democracy and equality for the entire solar system. All resources that go beyond the basics of our survival and the base standard of living go toward the building of the Lariat. It will open within the year and will finally make physical contact with the Kel Demokratia. Misty nodded Maria's head in agreement and said, a tad bit simplified, but this is a conversation, not a civics lecture. So what does the Kel want? The Kel are a democratic grouping of species. They follow the same rules and laws that we ourselves follow in WorldGov. Equity, democracy, standard of living. We've been assured this by our messengers who have the ability to read minds of the senders they contact, much like you appear to be doing to me. They can. I'm not sure reading a mind is accurate, but I guess you don't have any other sensory experience to compare it to, so I'll allow it. But the thing about reading a mind is you can only read the mind of the being you're in contact with. The Kel is hundreds of billions strong. Everyone won't see the same goals. Claire put down her punch and said, so let me guess. This is the part where you debunk what I've said about the Kel so you can win me over to whatever your Cincture believes. Oh, no. No, no. This is the part where I double down on what you said. For the Kel Demokratia, democracy is all that matters. They want to make the entire universe democratic. Literally, every sentient species should be allowed an equal vote in their GalGov system. Even if a species votes not to join the GalGov, the Kel are satisfied because the vote occurred. Y'all already voted, so that's kind of that. The vote serves as the role of a religion for the Kel. Which, nice touch with Christmas, by the way. I really like this human holiday. This isn't my first humbug, Claire, and I have to say, yours is my favorite so far. A lot less shanking, no crack prostitution in sight, and nobody is surviving an unwinnable war. One sec, Misty said, and paused to play with Maria's skinter face. The speaker changed songs to something else that was well over 100 years old. Horns and a scratching sound, and then a couple of rappers. I heard this song last time I had a Christmas, and it is so ridiculous that it's become one of my favorite parts of all of human popular culture. But, digression. Focus, Misty, where were you? The Kel. The Kel Demokrasha, upon opening of your domestic portal, will initiate an immediate galactic vote. You will be instantly and equally folded into their Galgov, and every sentient species in the Kel, that are within communication range, will be allowed an equivalent, accurately counted vote. It'll take a minute, because they'll look for a few other species like whales and octopus and maybe pigs before saying who all is sentient. They'll poke into the gas of Saturn and Jupiter, thank you very much, and even probe the depths of Europa just to check under all the beds. But it'll happen within a year or two. Claire asked, why would your group be opposed to that? As I said, Claire, we are not opposed to the Kel. They have done some wonderful things for the species they've contacted and helped build domestic portals for. As for opposition, we reserve it for other groups, like the Clockmakers, that would want you all rebooted as components for their eternal biological engine, or the Sisters of Tungsten, which are on an unholy jihad set to extinguish all biological life in the galaxy, killing themselves last, conveniently. They tend to drop London-sized chunks of tungsten on people from orbit. And I know you're thinking tungsten is rare, but only in your neighborhood, and the sisters spare no expense in destroying life. Claire wasn't certain what Misty meant about a biological engine, but assumed it was pretty awful if it was in the category of an extinction-level meteoric event. How many groups were out there, she wondered. The Kel had never let Earthlings know about the other groups. There are 49 groups linked to the domestic portals. They range from purely governmental to corporate for-profits to religious clutches, Misty said. Most expand very slowly. Generation ships crossing the cosmos to build a portal near a sun, they reach through sheer grit and patience. Only a handful of groups have metacogs strong enough to reach each other's societies and help them build a lariat, as the Kel have done with you. In fact, as far as we can tell, only the Kel and the Cincture actually know you exist, and the Kel got here first and swayed what was once called China to begin WorldGov. My people were slow to act, as they typically are. Claire asked, out loud this time, so are you going to tell me about your people or make me figure it out on my own? Sister, I am happy to. The Cincture is actually, well, I guess in terms from your history, we're a charity organization. We're dedicated to autonomy of all species, even though that often leads to bad falls for said species. Let's say we would be sort of like an eco-friendly, non-profit organization merged with a constitution that's loosely rooted in an ancient faith-based system of theoretical beliefs and principles. We're a smaller group. Others make fun of us and would call us hippies or tree huggers. Claire doubted much of what Misty said and wished very badly that she had the Alpha's ability to read other people's minds, even if that was an inaccurate term. She said, so I'm just supposed to believe that your Cincture is dedicated to goodness and improving the lot of all sentient life. Misty laughed, not the Maria laugh, and set down her punch. Oh my gosh, no, I did not say that. First, it's not my Cincture. Your pronoun use was almost accusatory. I'm a willing member, but I have no ownership over it, nor does anybody else. We don't believe in wealth. And I never said we were dedicated to improving sentient life. I said we're dedicated to the autonomy of all sentient life. That means we want the lariat to open and for you lot, so you can make every decision about how you use it, who comes through it, where you explore, who you trade with, you name it. I mean, 50-50, that ends up with you poking your finger in the Sisterhood of Tungsten's eyes, or having your solar system strip mined by the Abiding Cleft Corporation, but it'll be up to you, entirely. You will shine like angels or flush like turds, and the Cincture would love to hold your hand the whole way through. So answer me this, Claire said. Are you sided with the Deviants? And by you, I mean the Cincture as a group. Yes, we've supported the Deviants in our own small way since the dawn of the World Vote War. Not much we can do. The Kel prepared the predecessors of WorldGov for invasion impeccably well. Earth didn't stand a chance. and by the time my people looked up, the deed was done. Claire asked, "So how do you support the deviants? Are there a lot of stations like this facilitating communication?" "No," Misty said. "This is the only one." This station was a bad idea that Dr. Noelle turned good. She wasn't mentally stable. She had actually tried to kill herself roughly a year before she finally went ahead and did it. She'd walked out onto the surface of Ganymede, climbed a particular cliff she was enamored by, and intended to purge her oxygen while she looked up at the maw of Jupiter. She got there, heard the indicator that she only had about half of her oxygen left, and training kicked in. She panicked and headed home. Survival instincts are particularly strong for humans. "Why was she going to kill herself?" Claire asked. "Not at liberty to say. The things that drove her to go from being a beloved back engineer working directly for a messenger to a deviant living in a shit habitat on Ganymede took their toll. She was a real gift, though. I learned as much about humanity in a month with her as I have with my other contacts in over a century. That suicide attempt, ironically, was how she missed your father's slaughter. Do you suppose she only likes Christmas because her name is Noel?" Claire wondered what that meant. What was a Noel? "Never mind," Misty added. "Anyway, I won't tell you anything more about how we've talked to deviants in the past. You see WorldGov as the enemy of the deviants, even though it is more like a dysfunctional parent-child relationship. You see the Kel as the enemy of the Cincture, even though we've never had any true conflict in the millennia we have existed. Humans, Claire, have a very strong, very unique ability to see things only in a binary way. I mean, all your computer code is even in binary. Everything is WorldGov or deviant, peace or war, rich or poor. Shit, I mean, now or then, even time, a substrate of reality in which everything is interconnected and beautifully at one is broken into a now or a then with your brains. It's astounding. So let me get real, sister. I'm going to talk about your father. Was he a war hero or a murderer? A loyal member of the World Navy or a war criminal? The answer is he was both, and he was neither. You love him and have lived a life filled with admiration toward him, and now that's in doubt. Part of you hates him for what he did here, not 100 yards from where you're laying right now, but it's only part. The rest of you was learning to play catch and watching him give his speech as he helmed the old dame for the first time. You're hearing him fight with your mom in the other room and give you a model ship for your birthday. He isn't a hero or a heel. He's just a man. And you need to try your best to ditch that binary, baby. The lariat is closing. Or the lariat is tightening. But it isn't either. It's just a fucking portal that will open with the cooperation of another group of species on the other side of the galaxy. Might could be it's the Cincture. And we show you how things work, and we let you decide who to open your portal to, and what stars to set sail toward, and what weapons to build and cures to implement. It could be heaven on Earth, Christmas Eve every night of the year, or it could be an unmitigated disaster and wholesale death the likes of which your people can't even fathom. But odds are, your first galactic handshake will be with the Kel. You have much more stability and security with the Kel than with the Cincture. But ironically, despite their call for democracy, you'll have virtually no freedom, because the galactic vote will kick in, and 310 billion beings will suddenly vote for the future of Earth. Environmental policy, resource sharing, who gets to use the portal and when. It will be your 8 billion voting along 310 billion others. They will vote, as they always do, for the good of the majority. And humans and dolphins, you will very much be in the minority. Do you know why America and the UK and Germany and Australia fought so hard in the world vote wars? Because they were the ones who had something to lose. Your commander Begay, his great-grandfather fought a dog to the death so his family could eat it and survive another day in the streets of India. That same day, a fat kid in Des Moines was having a fit because he couldn't get a Happy Meal. Look it up. My fear, and I mean mine, Misty, the individual, well, as much as any of my species can be called an individual, my fear is that your people are going to be rolled right over. You will not like it. You are binary. Us or them. and the Kel, who right now are sky gods beaming you miracles, will be the ones taking your jobs and using your portal and terraforming your planets for their species, and you will suddenly count them as the enemy. And you will all be the bottom 1%. All of humanity will be deviant, stuck under the weight of the population, technology, and superiority of the system you willingly joined. You won't be killed by tungsten, and you won't be scrubbed clean by the abiding cleft corporation who just wants your stuff, but you won't be free. And that's something your race strives for. You're only trying to build this lariat because you see it as a new frontier to be explored and colonized. The instant you all had decent spacefaring ships, you set out for Ganymede and the Moon and Mars. You set out to conquer. You conquer, Claire, not necessarily by military, but often by military. Your days of conquering are over with the Kel. With us, you can show us where you want to conquer, and we'll show you the best way to get there. You will be autonomous and free and facing the greatest adventure humanity has ever known and the greatest threat and chance for extinction from external forces or some dipshit who weaponizes something you've learned from us. Neither one of them is the right decision, until it is. But time is linear for you, so there's no telling what's to come. And for those who don't see time in that way, what's to come is what's to come, so there's no reason to fight the future. It's like fighting gravity. It already exists, and it's already pulling you in one direction. So there it is. That's my speech, Claire, and we're almost out of time. And I think I prefer American Christmas music to Mexican Christmas music, and you probably don't care much about the last thing I said. Claire cut to it. Look, Misty, I need to find the Deviant Alpha. That is my mission. It is the only reason I fucking broke Navy protocol to come down here and sit in this funky chair. I thought I might learn something somehow, since this entire facility seems dedicated to it. If Dr. Noel was not the Deviant Alpha, who is it? Misty's shoulders slumped as if she had failed in something. She sighed. Everyone points to Christmas as the most wonderful day of the year. But you know what I think, Claire? I think Christmas Eve is probably more powerful than Christmas. It is the moment before Schrodinger's box opens. The cat is dead alive. Your binary human existence hasn't forced it to be one or the other yet. You have no idea what is in that foil-wrapped gift waiting for you under the tree. They are pure potentiality, their wave function in no way collapsed. They are both the new bike and the Millennium Falcon toy. They're the record player you've wanted all year and the Holly Hobby Easy Bake Oven. Sorry, my references are out of date because things used to be awesome and now they're lame. To you, an alpha must be either WorldGov or Deviant. There's no possibility for something in the middle. I've spoken to the same messenger almost every night since the World Vote War. So is the Kel Demokrasha. He's on your ship right now. He's a crazy old goat of a bastard who never makes any sense because he lost a war a century ago. And he won that war at the same time. He learned the lessons of Eleanor Gray, the real Eleanor Gray, his friend, not your ship. They survived the war together, and then he built WorldGov in the rubble of the war, and simultaneously, he laid long winding plans for its destruction. He's doing everything in his power to get the Kel Demokrasha to open the other side of the lariat. And that is because he's doing everything in his power to get the Cincture to open the lariat instead. He is the greatest mind ever produced by humanity, and he battles with his selves. He doesn't even know what is the right course of action anymore. The lariat is closing, the lariat is tightening. The cat is dead alive. It all has driven him quite mad, and he knows it. And he's relying on you, Claribel Campana, to make a very binary decision that he can no longer make. You're in for a rocky couple of months, my dear. There will be a mutiny on your ship, and a war for the sun, and one for the earth. Post-humans will wage battle on your very decks, and the gears of decision will be yours alone to turn. I know you have doubts you can make the right call as the captain of your ship, but you're being called upon to make an infinitely bigger decision than any mere captain can make. The Kel or the Cincture? WorldGov or the Deviants? The clock will strike midnight soon, Claire, and it will no longer be Christmas Eve. The magic of that holy night's potentiality will spill into the world and set things as if concrete. But if you're a good little girl, and you make the hard call right when it needs to be made, humanity will get exactly what it always wanted for Christmas. And thus ends chapter 32 and our current look at the life of Captain Claire Campana. As always, I want to thank you for going on this ride with us. Again, if you're listening to this lifetime, I want to wish you a Merry Christmas and thank you for joining us on this Christmas special. And if you're listening to it out of sequence, then I want to wish you a Merry Christmas for next year when Christmas comes around again. As always, if you like what I'm doing, you can check out my other book, 181 Pine, that you can buy on our website, mindframepodcast.com. If you're a patron and you listen to our bonus episodes, you can also find the writings of Zach Smith, who helps host the bonus episodes with us, the sit-downs, and you can find all of that on our website in the shop, as well as some cool MindFrame merch and other things like that. As always, we are a member of the Podbelly Podcast family, and you can find other great shows like the Ectoplasm Podcast and Hillbilly Horror Stories, and you can find that on podbelly.com. Anywhere that you get your podcasts, there are great things there that you can download and start to listen to. So give it a look, and I think you'll find stuff that you enjoy. Finally, another great way that you can support us, other than Patreon, is just to give us a share, give us a like. You know, when we post something, repost it. Let us know what you think. Other than just support of the show, like I've said, a lot of times if I'm not really feeling like writing, I'll see some posts of people who really appreciate a chapter or people sharing theories or ideas about the show, and it really does inspire me and set me off to writing and keep me fired up. So I love interacting. I love the ways that you communicate on social media. And you can find us on various social mediums. So if your Facebook is your scene, you can find us on Facebook at MindFrame Podcast. If Twitter is your thing, we are MindFrame Pod. And on Instagram, we are the MindFrame Podcast. So thank you for listening. And as always, the lariat is tightening.